Terry Evans is one of those artists whose impact goes beyond the art world. She photographs the land from airplanes and captures truths we all live with on the ground, but from a vantage point that allows her to see things we tend to miss. And that's a big deal. In some cases, legislation has come about as a result of what people have learned from Terry's photographs about what's happening all around them, whether it's the crackling of a glacier in Greenland or mountains of a toxic substance called petcoke piling up outside of oil plants in Chicago. But if you search through the online collection of the Spencer Museum of Art at KU, where Terry went to school, you'll find images that might surprise you, images taken when Terry was a student in the 70s. One of my favorites is called Four Boys at Barn Entrance. In that picture, four sweaty teenage boys crowd around an open barn door in jeans and t-shirts and work boots. It's like a black and white snapshot of really hard work mixed with innocence and summer fun. If you've ever been on a farm in Kansas in the summertime, you know what I'm talking about. I'm Gina Kaufman. And today on KCUR's Central Standard, we're going to hear the story that begins in Kansas City, meanders through the prairies of Kansas, and ultimately leads to fighting climate change with the camera. Terry Evans, good morning.
Good morning, Gina.
Right now, the Spencer Museum in Lawrence is showing some of your work as part of an alumni show. And I wonder what it's like for you to come back to your roots for that show, not just geographically, but photographically.
It is a return, but I return often, and I did live in central Kansas for something like 27 years before moving to Chicago, where I now live. And it was there outside of Salina, Kansas, on a small farm place where my husband and I lived, that I really fell in love with the landscape. And that picture you just described was actually one of the first projects that I worked on, called No Mountains in the Way, which was directed by Jim Inyart and funded by the National Endowment for the Arts. And we were photographing rural Kansas in 1974. I graduated from KU from the Department of Drawing and Painting in 1968. And so returning for this current show has been a real pleasure to see it, because it's a beautiful show, because it represents the work of so many artists who graduated from KU.
You're from Kansas City. Tell me about your childhood, like where exactly you grew up, what it was like for you here.
Oh, I love Kansas City. And so I'm just going to tell you the places I lived in Kansas City, because maybe some of your listeners live in those neighborhoods. So I was born and lived until I was, I think, seven, around 38th and Mercer. And then I moved out to 74th and Bellevue. My family moved out there, my parents and my sister and I. And then some years after that, we moved to 69th and Brookside, and I lived there until I left home at age 18. So Kansas City was, I think one of the most important things about Kansas City for me was the Nelson Atkins Museum of Art. And I started taking art lessons there when I was 4 years old, and continued for a number of years. And that museum is such a place full of treasures for me. I loved to explore the museum.
Do you remember what it felt like for you as a little kid to be in this sort of like grand place, but also to feel like you had a home there in a way? It sounds like if you go there for lessons all the time, it's not like this place up on a hill that's,
exactly.
You know what I mean?
Yeah, exactly. No, I loved it. My father would drop me off. Now, you know, maybe when he was four, surely he got out and walked me down the steps, down to the lower level to the classes. But what I remember, I must have been a little bit older, but I remember My father dropping me off, and I'd go in and run down the steps to the museum, to the education level, and have my art class. And then afterwards, I would usually have, 10 minutes or so before he picked me up. And so I would explore the museum. I loved it. There was nothing that seemed intimidating. It was all exciting. My favorite room was, there was a room with a large Chinese Buddha with glass eyes that seemed to follow you around the room as you moved around the room. And there was a guard who would stand over by the door and make sort of scary noises in fun with me. So that was really great.
You know, you've mentioned that your dad was dropping you off for these art lessons. Can you tell me a little bit about your parents?
Oh, my parents were a wonderful inspiration, support for my interest in art. My dad was a photographer, and my mother and father had a wedding and portrait studio at 63rd and Brookside, Norman Hoyt Photography. And then what my dad really loved to photograph was what he called scenery. And so he would take me with him sometimes on Saturday mornings. We would drive out into the country around Kansas City and go exploring, and he would make photographs. Both of my parents were so encouraging. You know, I was an okay student. I was not a poor student, but I also was not an outstanding student. But I always got A's in art, and I can remember bringing my report card home, and the only thing my dad really cared about was that grade. You know,
got
my art grade, and so you got an A- in art. What was wrong? What happened? So they were wonderfully supportive.
And it sounds like they identified from a pretty young age that you had some abilities in this area.
They did, I guess, just because that was always my favorite thing to do, was to draw and make pictures.
You did go to school for art at KU, but I understand you didn't have the intention of becoming a photographer when you did that.
Oh, no, I didn't. And I studied drawing and painting. My favorite teacher was Peter Thompson, who is now a good friend of mine. In those days, he was Mr. Thompson. But I learned so much from him and from other teachers there, too. And I assumed that I would continue that. But then in my last semester at KU, which was the spring of 1968, Bobby Kennedy came to the University of Kansas campus to begin his campaign for the presidency. And my father had a beautiful Nikon camera, which in those days was something that only a professional would have had. And he loaned me his Nikon, which somehow gave me access to be down on the floor of the field house with people.
When you say somehow, I mean, can you explain, at least from your memory, how that worked? Like having a camera gave
you... There were real press photographers there and journalists from all over the country. I remember meeting a Time magazine photographer and a NBC camera person. I mean, just sort of hello in passing there. But why would they let me, a student, join them? And the only thing I can think of is because my camera looked like I knew what I was doing. So, but the effect for me was that I discovered that photographing could be an interface with the world. It was a much different experience than sitting by myself in my studio painting. I really loved thinking that the camera was a way to explore the world and to answer questions that I wondered about and gain me access. So that first experience of access has continued all my life. It seems that the camera has been a ticket and an access into meeting people and being in places that I would not otherwise have ever known.
When you talk about, you know, you got onto the floor where press photographers were when Bobby Kennedy came through Kansas for his campaign in 68. What were your, first of all, what was that like being on the floor with those photographers at this historic moment?
It was really exciting. And, you know, I got some decent pictures. They weren't particularly outstanding, but it was so exciting. It did make me feel that I was participating in a historical event. And of course, soon after that, he was killed in June. And I think probably I would not have had that easy access after that. You know, we were still rather naive at that time.
Do you
about security needs?
Yeah. Do you think that experience? I mean, you've said that the camera has continued to be this source of access to a kind of experience you wouldn't otherwise have had. But I wonder how that has shaped the kind of photographer you've become. That initial epiphany that like this camera can take me places.
Well, my first project was. I wanted to understand conditions of poverty in Kansas and Missouri because I grew up in a very middle-class neighborhood and middle-class background. And that was when President Johnson had declared a war on poverty. And we thought in those days that we could eliminate poverty if we just worked hard enough on it for the next few years. And I wanted to see that. I wanted to understand what it was like to live extremely poor. And so I went to an organization called Crosslines in Kansas City, directed by an amazing, energetic and kind Methodist minister, the Reverend Don Bakley. And I told him I wanted to tell these stories. It seemed from the very beginning for me with photography that the photography would be a way to tell stories. And so he introduced me to lots of the people they served and introduced me to the neighborhoods in Kansas City, Kansas, where they were doing their programs. And so So I visited often, and by then I was married and living in north of Salina, and I also worked in north central Kansas. But the camera, I guess it wasn't only, I think the way it gave me access is that it gave me a reason to call someone up and say, you know, I'm interested in this. Might I come and photograph? And
That's easier than saying, might I come?
Sure. And also, it's not as if I only wanted to tell the stories. The making of the pictures was central. And making pictures to tell the stories. And I would return often until I thought I really had the right pictures. And I would always give pictures to the people I was photographing, too. That was only fair.
What do you remember about those experiences in Kansas City, Kansas, during the Johnson administration, where just people you met or realizations that you had?
Oh, I remember being very touched by the people I met because most people outside of their own families and neighborhoods were not interested in their stories. So I think they were pleased that I was interested. And so inadvertently, it turned out to be a project that for me allowed me to think that, oh, well, this is okay. People want to, they will let me photograph them, and they do want to tell me their stories.
They want to be seen.
Yes, they want to be seen. You know, there was a lovely young girl standing on a porch listening to a radio, and after I looked for a minute or two, I realized that she was blind. And so the radio was her communication with the world. There was a lovely old couple in their late 80s that I visited several times. And about the fourth time I went back, just the man came to the door, and he said, Mama died last week. And so, you know, I was able to engage with people in their lives, in the lives that were moving in ways that I began to understand.
You know, the camera was a big epiphany for you, and where it could take you was a big epiphany. But it also seems like the prairie was a pretty significant discovery for you. And I, you mentioned sort of in passing that by this point you're living on a farm near Salina. But maybe can you start on your prairie journey by telling us how you, as this person who's grown up in Midtown and Brookside, Kansas City, ends up on a farm in Salina with a camera?
Well, this wasn't a working farm, but it was a place, a farmhouse, a late 19th century farmhouse that belonged to my husband's parents, and we rented it from them, and we fixed it up so we could live in it. And my husband really taught me what it meant to live outside of a city, because out there, there was space and sky, and every morning he would wake up and go to the window on the second floor where our bedroom was, and he'd look out. You could look really far to the north, and he would say, "Oh, what a beautiful day it is!" It didn't matter if it was thunderstorms or snowing or sleet or whatever it was. He loved the weather, and so he taught me just by that example to love it and to see it and to want to be in that landscape. Still, it was also in those early days that I was going to Kansas City to photograph poverty in Kansas, and I had no intention of photographing landscape. Pictures of landscape didn't inspire me. I saw the grand pictures made by Ansel Adams, and I thought they were boring. And I saw, you know, pictures
just because there weren't people in them?
I don't know. They weren't interesting. I had no interest. I guess so, sure. They weren't people. So what in the world would you say about landscape, you know? So then a friend of mine, Wes Jackson, the director of the Land Institute in Salina, was doing some research on a nearby virgin prairie. This was a piece of land, 80 acres, that belonged to Nick and Joyce Fent out north of Salina, and it had never been plowed or pastured or burned, or it was a completely virgin prairie, which they mowed once a year for the hay. And so Wes Jackson and his students were doing plant counts there. They were laying down a meter square grid and trying to discover the patterns of planting so that they could get some ideas of how to make a sustainable agriculture based on the prairie ecosystem.
So like they were trying to study how nature kind of organized plants on its own.
Thank you. That's a good way to say it. Yes. Yes.
And he invited you to help reveal
that
through photographs?
Yeah, they just asked me if, as a favor, could I make some pictures of this work they were doing? And so I did that. But in doing that, I walked around a lot while they were working. And I started in March. This was 1978. So 40 years ago, 41 years ago. So I started in March. And I started, and things started growing, and I started seeing that this was vastly different than my own front yard, which was just all the same species of grass. So here were, you know, I could stand and look at the ground in front of me for a long time before I would see everything that was growing there. You know, there were so many species growing together. And so it was so fascinating. There was such diversity and complexity. And so I wanted to photograph it. I just wanted to understand those patterns. And so I started photographing in black and white, and I had this Hasselblad camera that I would hold at, with a wide-angle lens, I would hold it at waist level looking at the ground. I never wanted to make pictures that looked like calendars. I wanted to see the pattern and structure. And I had this idea that if I could only understand the structure of the prairie, then I might understand the structure of the universe. Because here was this untouched botanical entity that was very complicated, and everything I was seeing was existing in relationship with everything else. You know, it was much different than the wheat field next door, which was just wheat. You know, here were, I don't really know how many plants on that particular prairie, but hundreds of different kinds of plants. And so, forbs and grasses. And so, I made these pictures. I made thousands, I think something like 6,000 black and white.
More than pictures. He had probably imagined when he invited you to come and document.
Oh,
it.
I wasn't even working for them anymore.
Yeah,
I made the pictures he wanted. So these were not of interest even. Well, maybe they were. I don't know if they were of interest to the Land Institute, but they were fascinating to me. So I had recorded the work they were doing by photographing these wooden frames, and then I was just off. And most of the days, and so then I went out there almost every day. And but only when the light was right. I didn't want sunlight casting shadows. I wanted just to see what was there, just these complex patterns. So most of the times when I went, the Land Institute people weren't even there. They finished their work, and I just kept going out there. And finally, Nick and Joyce Fent, who owned it, gave me a key to the gate, which was a huge honor to me, so that I could go whenever I wanted.
I just want to jump in and say, you know, these photographs, these early photographs you took of the Kansas prairie, I mean, I think a lot of people see them as groundbreaking. And nowadays, the Flint Hills, the prairie, there's some cachet to that. There's a bit of a movement toward more acknowledgement of the subtle beauty in that landscape. But when I was growing up in the 80s, that was not really a thing that people talked about.
So no
you were
one...
doing this before there was like a prairie obsession of a kind, you know?
Oh, I had never even heard of prairie and, you know, except that I thought it was, you know, maybe Laura Ingalls Wilder, Little House on the Prairie, and I knew about wagon trains coming across the prairie, but I never thought about the prairie, the ground itself. I mean, we're talking about a whole ecosystem existing in the ground. We're not talking about mountains and oceans and forests. This is all happening on the ground.
It's out there in the hills.
I mean, it is. Yeah, it is happening in the sky and with, you know, with the whole enormity of the universe. But you have to look down to see it.
I just want to say that the first epiphany seems to be the camera, and the second seems to be the prairie, but the third is the airplane.
Oh, well, that happened soon after I started photographing the prairie, because I was looking for these patterns. And I was reading everything I could find that seemed related. I was reading about medicinal uses of plants by Plains Indians, the first people who were appreciating the prairie and the prairies. And then I was reading fiction, Willa Cather, and I was reading about grass systematics. And I was also reading something about medieval cosmology and literature. Excuse me. And I learned about this idea of as above, so below, that sort of in God's eye view, So I started wondering if I actually were to go above the prairie, would I see these same sort of patterns and forms and structure? Only larger. So I arranged to fly in a small plane, a Cessna 172. And started doing some aerial photography, which at first was really hard just because I was not good. I would get airsick every time. But I very quickly got used to it. And it was easy to do it in Salina, Kansas.
Well, photographer Terry Evans, stay with me through this break, okay?
Sure.
I'm Gina Kaufman. When KCUR's Central Standard returns, we'll hear the stories of what Terry Evans has witnessed at fracking sites in North Dakota, in an airplane over melting glaciers, and over industrial sites in Chicago neighborhoods where mountains of toxic substances visible from the air were piling up. This is a Portrait Session. Stay tuned. I'm Gina Kaufman. This is KCUR's Central Standard, and we're talking to photographer Terry Evans, a Kansas City native. If you can picture the beauty of the Kansas prairie without ever having been there yourself, there is a good chance her photographs are the reason. If you've seen pieces of glaciers falling into the ocean without ever having flown over Greenland yourself, again, there is a good chance Terry Evans is the reason. And those are the stories we're about to hear. Hi, Terry.
Hi, Gina.
So I really just want to go on some trips with you now, project to project, to hear about your experiences. We talked about some of your early work photographing the prairie. Can you take me to some of your early projects in Chicago?
Sure. I think, you know, I didn't really want to move to Chicago. I didn't want to leave my beloved prairie. But what I discovered when I got to Chicago is that there is prairie here, too. And so one of my first projects was to photograph the former Joliet Arsenal, which was, I think, about 50,000 acres of land that had been taken by the Department of the Army in World War II to build ammunition production supplies. And it was and it was active in World War II, the Korean War, and the Vietnam War, and then was closed and was gradually being transferred from the Department of the Army to the U.S. Forest Service to be preserved. So it was filled with ammunition storage bunkers and remains of early settler houses. And I mean, not exactly remains, but foundations, an old Civil War stone fence. And it was huge and fascinating. And so I explored that very large area and photographed it in a way that was similar to photographing the prairie in Kansas, where I started thinking about prairie. And there's a kind of continuity that has run through all of my projects that is about land and how it's used. And specifically, the prairie has been this ongoing inspiration. So that project was a great chance for me to explore a much larger area. I've always felt as much like an explorer as an artist. It's the exploring that is really great fun. And that work became a book and was sponsored by Open Lands Project, which is a great organization here that does significant conservation work. And that work led also to an exhibition at the Chicago Art Institute of that project and several others. So But anyway, you go on. Ask me what else, because that's one project. You know, I have many projects.
I am. Okay, so of the Chicago projects, of course, I mean, I think one of the most intriguing is this Petcoke versus Grassroots project. Can you explain that?
And that happened just recently I think I started photographing there in 2014. But what happened is that I kept going with Prairie. I kept moving from one way to explore to another, even photographing museum specimens of grasses and birds and collected on the prairies and plains. And then until, it just seemed that one idea led to another until finally my friend and colleague Elizabeth Farnsworth and I started exploring the oil boom in North Dakota, and which was about fracking in North Dakota. And that I found it very disturbing to the land, disturbing to the people who were living there in many ways. We can talk about that more if you want to later, because it was about several complex issues. And then when I finished that, and that was just, let's see, I finished that in 2012, I think, yes. And I thought then, I realized I've been telling the stories of the prairie. I've always, since I discovered the prairie, I have felt like that was my job. That's my job as an artist, is to tell the stories of the prairie. And so after doing that work in North Dakota, I felt like it was not only my job to tell the stories, but it was my job to be a very explicit and direct advocate for the prairie. And so I became much more of an activist. And through the Natural Resource Defense Council here in Chicago, I learned about what was happening on the southeast side of Chicago, which is that there were large piles of petroleum coke being stored in a very poor Hispanic neighborhood. And the dust from the petroleum coke was blowing into the neighborhoods and affecting the people.
I want to back up and explain. This is a byproduct from an oil plant?
So oil from the Alberta tar sands, which is the dirtiest oil that we can gather, was shipped down. It's shipped to a number of places. In this case, it's shipped to the BP refinery, which is just over the line in Indiana, just over the Chicago line on the southeast side of Chicago in Indiana. And so there, the oil from the tar sands would be refined, and the waste from it is called petcoke, petroleum coke.
Okay.
And that is used as a fuel. It's a very dirty fuel, and it's used in manufacturing. Because it's so dirty, it's not even allowed to be used in a lot of places in this country. So it might be shipped to India and China and other places.
But you saw what is it that you saw?
So the petcoke is shipped by rail in open boxcars from the BP refinery over to the southeast side of Chicago. It was. It's not now. And so it's large piles of what looked like coal, and they were sitting in this space beside the Calumet River, and in this space owned by the Koch brothers, Koch Industries, and it would pile very high, and it didn't take very much for it to start blowing into the neighborhood. There's a very high rate of asthma among children in that neighborhood, and really anyone who lived there was breathing it into their lungs. So there was a small activist group that formed, a grassroots activist group, And I joined them and told their stories with my photographs. I told the stories of what was happening and the work they were doing. We had marches. They finally got the attention of the mayor of Chicago and downtown, and some changes began to happen.
But
and
can I
now,
just say that? Well, yes, finish that. Go ahead.
So Petco is certain regulations were required that it be covered so that it wouldn't blow into the neighborhood, and it was too expensive to cover it. So they simply shut down that that storage site.
But it's still, before your photographs, people did not, many people in Chicago, I would say most people in Chicago from what I've read, didn't realize that this was even happening.
Oh, I think my photographs were part of what brought the story to attention, but certainly the main part of what brought it to attention was the enormous energy and activity of the local activists. You know, I don't live there. I live in Hyde Park, Chicago, so I live maybe not far, but 20 or 30 minutes away from that, from the southeast side. And it was the people on the southeast side who really made the changes happen. And I was able to be part of having an exhibition happen of my work and other people's work at the Museum of Contemporary Photography. And so we could tell the stories there. And the Chicago Magazine published an article that used my photographs. So I was involved in bringing it to broader attention. But really, it was the local activists who really deserve the credit.
You know, the project that I think I and a lot of other people who have followed your work are dying to know about is the Glacier Project in Greenland, because kind of like with that Bobby Kennedy image that got you hooked, your camera in that case gave you access to a perspective most of us don't have except through your photos, because we can't go to Greenland.
Oh, I was so excited to go there. And that was something that is completely because of the Spencer Museum of Art, who commissioned me to do this work, because they were particularly interested in having a collaboration with the scientists at the Center for Remote Sensing of Ice Sheets at KU. And the director there, Sarah Lynn Hardy, has always thought it was very important for art to reach into the larger community, and in this case, into the larger campus. And so she finds all kinds of ways and ideas.
But can you take us to Greenland?
Yes. So for about a year before I went to Greenland, I spent time visiting with the scientists and making some photographs at the Center for Remote Sensing of Ice Sheets at KU. And then that summer, I went to Greenland while they were there, and I did some aerial work. The thing that was so fascinating to me about the aerial work, you know, I thought it would be a way for me to tell this story, but it
the
was
the story
very,
of climate change.
Yes, and the story of what these glaciers look like. The story, you know, the story of climate change is a very complicated and huge story. So the melting of the ice sheets is one part of it. And there's no way to actually show that except through video work, I think, and or through before and after pictures. But I thought that if I could at least show the scale of the glaciers, we would have some understanding.
In just a minute, we'll chat with Terry Evans about her perspective on glaciers, but also creativity and how photography has changed since she got started. I'm Gina Kaufman. This is a portrait session with Terry Evans on KCUR's Central Standard.
We're back. We've got just a little time left for our conversation with Terry Evans, a Kansas City native whose photographs have taken her all over the world, often from an airplane. And she comes back with images that show us beauty and also tell us a lot about ourselves and how we're shaping the planet now and into the future. She's speaking with us from her current home in Chicago. Terry Evans, welcome back.
Thank you.
So you do, we got into a little bit about your trip to photograph a melting glacier in Greenland. Can you tell me a little bit more about what it was you saw there?
Sure. I saw from the plane what looked like something that I couldn't understand the scale of, because I couldn't tell if what I was seeing were piles of snow that were maybe about the size of the piles I shovel along my sidewalk when it snows, or were they 20 stories high? It was very hard to read it because there was no human scale there. So when I got back home, I was able to cut out little tiny pictures of other aerial pictures I had made of the same scale and put them on the glacier pictures just so that I could actually see the scale. And then it was easy to read them as 20 or 30 stories high as they actually were. So that became an exhibition. That work about the glaciers became an exhibition, and it was extremely interesting to begin to understand how the scientists work to we were both trying to understand the glacier in very different ways.
You've managed to carve out a very definite place for yourself in the art world in an era where women still, in many cases, really struggle to do that. In fact, you were one of the recipients of the Anonymous Was a Woman Award. Can you talk about just your journey in that respect?
Let's see. I don't even know how to talk about it. I think that's because, yes, for me, it's always been what I was talking about earlier, which is exploring places and subjects and contacting people. I have not felt excluded because I was a woman. The only way I have felt excluded sometimes is from, I think, my own elevation of the voices of men, and it took me a long time as a woman to begin to speak with my own power and understand that that I could speak as with the same confidence from my own experiences. So that's what happened. I want to say one more thing. I would like to talk about one more thing before we close, which is about something that started with, for me, in this is a different subject, something that started but related. When I started photographing the prairies over 40 years ago, I think I began to understand a human relationship to nature. But what's been happening for me over the past 2 years is this increased feeling of a need to understand my relationship, our relationship to life other than human. You know, what kind of connection and relationship do we really have with nature? What do trees have to say to us? What do the grasses have to say to us? What can we learn? And how can we learn from the protected ecosystems that still thrive because of human care? So this has become really important to me, and in terms of this is the exploration that I'm on right now.
Yeah, but you have actually said that you got into it not being interested in landscape photography, that you were bored by Ansel Adams, and that what interested you was people and people's stories. And to some extent, it sounds like what you're saying is that that's still what you're talking about. In terms of how people shape the land?
No, what I'm talking about right now is the stories of the plants and the trees and the animals and understanding that they are equally as important as we people are. And so the work I'm doing now is more about that. And it's about, for example, I've been photographing lately in a place called the Wooded Island, which is in Chicago, in Jackson Park. And it's a place that used to be Oak Savanna. Oak Savanna is the ecosystem that is the transition between prairie and forest. And it survived and exists because as prairie fires burned through, oak trees could withstand the fires. And so it remained to be an almost park-like configuration of trees and grasses. And that's what was existing here on the south side of Chicago. And then a lagoon was built around this certain area in Jackson Park for the Columbian Exposition. And there are still very old oak trees there. And there's one that I've been photographing now all winter, trying to make one of these new composite sort of pictures that I'm making. And I learned recently that it's 300 years old. So even as it was having a moat built around it, it had already been standing there since 1718 or 19, and so this is fascinating to me. What does this tree know, and what has its life been? And it's a very complicated tree with very winding and interesting branches. And I can never quite see the whole thing. So I keep going back and back and back, trying to thoroughly see and maybe, if I'm lucky, understand what it's like to be this ancient oak tree.
Wow. You know, with this approach to art and creativity, which is to be an explorer, and also to be an observer and an activist and a student. How do you define creativity?
Oh, my goodness. What a hard question. How do I define creativity? Well, I think, you know, we are all creative. It's about how we draw connections among things, among ideas, among things we see, and how we make new connections, maybe how we live in relationship to the people and the earth around us, and the earth itself keeps creating itself. So we're part of that process. I don't know. That's probably not exactly what you mean.
Well, you come back to the prairie after having seen fracking in North Dakota, after having seen glaciers in Greenland, after having explored Chicago and really been all over the world. Do you see the prairie differently now, speaking of making connections, having seen all of this other stuff?
I think I do see it. I do see it differently now. I appreciate it even more. I went back to the Flint Prairie to photograph there again, the one where I started in 1978, and it felt like coming home. I knew plants there that are different. They're different than what I see on Illinois prairies, and so there's a feeling of recognition and homecoming and also newness.
Yeah. Well, Terry Evans, it has been a pleasure speaking with you. Thanks so much for being today's portrait session subject on KCUR's Central Standard.
Oh, thank you so much.
Terry is one of the KU alums in a show at the Spencer Museum in Lawrence called The Power of Place. It's a homecoming of sorts for a lot of Kansas artists, and you can check it out through June 30th. More information is at spencerart.ku.edu. That's a wrap for today and for the week. You can catch any of the discussions you might have missed at kcur.org/centralstandard.
If you are not aware that we are descended from a fish ancestor and that that creature that linked the land mammals to fish walked upright with a flat head like a crocodile's head, you definitely need to listen back to our conversation with scientist Neil Shubin. That was Tuesday, and you can get it at kcur.org/centralstandard. Talk to us anytime on Twitter. We are at KCURCST, and we love to chat with you and hear what you are thinking about, what you want to hear us covering. At KCURCST, this show is produced by KCUR's Melody Rowell with Chris Young, Coy Duggar, Suzanne Hogan, and intern Salisa Kalakal. Sylvia Maria Gross is our senior producer. I'm Gina Kaufman. Have a great weekend.